Thank you. I think. So before I get started, I want to warn you about a couple things. I'm using some hardware and some software techniques that are a little different from normal, so you'll have to bear with me. Also, my laptop has been giving me a lot of trouble in the last few days. So hopefully I can get through this without too much embarrassment. Well, that's a little bit too much to ask. Also, I've taken the liberty to change the name of my talk. Actually, I wanted to use language that was a little stronger than this, but Robin Knupp, who, for those of you who don't know, is my boss, told me that I couldn't do it. She told me I would embarrass Swery, and I tried to convince her it was already too late, but she still wouldn't let me do it. But what I'm going to talk about is ice giant migration under the influence of a protoplanetary disk without any gas and all this complicated stuff. Most of the work, matter of fact, here they go, heading south for the winter. And, excuse me? So, okay, serious now, okay. I didn't hear. Excuse me?
Why are there so many Neptunes that fall in the group?
Never mind. If you can't figure it out. Anyway. So the work that I'm going to be talking about today is mainly based on this paper by Rodney Gomez, Morby, and myself. And indeed, I played a fairly small role. I really just kibitzed. So most of this work really is by Morby and Rodney. So if you have any complaints, there's Morby. I'll also talk a little bit about some work that Luke Dones and a bunch of us are doing on the formation of the Oort cloud, and also talk a little bit about the Kuiper belt. So the basic outline of the talk, I'll start off with some just migration basics, talk about the standard interpretation for our solar system, talk about problems with that interpretation. It's a good thing Renew's not here. And our suggested solution and applications, if I have time, to other systems. Excuse me?
You're on the web.
Ooh.
Yes.
Thanks. Okay, so the basic idea of this migration is if you start off with the four giant planets and embed them in a protoplanetary disk, this contains roughly 10,000 particles in this simulation and let them go. Uranus and Neptune start scattering these objects. You can see these nice, well-defined, what we call Tisserand tails coming up. But what's happening is that Neptune's not very good at actually ejecting things from the solar system. So anything that gets scattered out by Neptune usually comes back. But if you look over here, Neptune's actually fairly good at handing things back off to Uranus and Saturn. So there's a net flux of material moving in, and as a result, Neptune moves out. This was actually discovered 20 years ago or so by Fernandez and Ip, but it was pretty much ignored in the literature until Renu Malhotra pointed out that we can explain some of the structures of the Kuiper belt by the outward migration of Neptune. Let me just show you a little toy animation showing eccentricity as a function of semi-major axis, and I have Neptune here the 2 to 3 and 1 to 2 mean motion resonances. This red line represents a bunch of particles. Everything's very cold, so this is an extreme case, but if you let Neptune migrate and push it out, the particles get trapped in these mean motion resonances and have their eccentricities increased. Every object up here is actually trapped in the mean motion resonance at the end of this little demonstration. And thank you. People have used this to explain the resonance structure. This is actual observations of real Kuiper belt objects. Again, eccentricity versus semi-major axis. And you can see in through here this resonance structure that people attribute to the outward migration of Neptune. Okay, so let me start off actually with a description of some of the work that Rodney did. He started off with a protoplanetary disk extending from 18 to 50 AU with a surface density that falls off as r to the minus 1. We put the giant planets in this configuration. And the only thing we really varied from simulation to simulation here was the mass of the disk. So this shows Neptune's semi-major axis as a function of time. You can see Neptune starts off moving and then sort of flattens out and reaches sort of an end state with a mass of around 40 Earth masses. If we increase the mass a little bit, it moves a little bit further. But if we increase the mass yet again, we get a totally different behavior. Okay? Here, Neptune settles down for a while and then just takes off and will just motor through the disk until it reaches the end of the disk. So we have really two different types of migration here. Morby and I tried for a long time to come up with a designation for this, something that's both descriptive and unique. So we decided to call this type 1 migration and type 2 migration. No, actually, we decided to call it BAMP migration for the particles that go out and just settle down, and forced migration for particles that or objects that go to the end of the disk. We actually have a type 3 migration, but I don't think I'm going to have a chance to talk about this. Now, we have a little toy model that I can present to explain this, but because we're short on time, I was originally given 40 minutes to talk, then 30 minutes, then 20 minutes to talk. I'm not going to cover that now. Excuse me, I'm down to 10 minutes? Yeah. Well, I actually complained at one point that if I just extrapolated, I wouldn't have to talk at all. But the important, the important thing to note about this is this: the boundary between forced and runaway migration occurs for a disk that's only about 20 Earth masses inside of 30 AU. And we'll use that, make use of that later. So the standard interpretation for all this has been, we have a really nice story. Okay, the giant planets formed in a disk of roughly 50 Earth masses, something like 20 Earth masses inside of 30 AU. Neptune formed at 23 AU, and we need 23 AU because to explain the eccentricities we see in the 2 to 3 librators in the Kuiper belt. Migrated to 30 AU, stopped because it was damp migration in a low density disk. Okay, that leaves a roughly 30 Earth masses beyond 30 AU, and this is a good number because when we look at the big Kuiper belt objects, it didn't, you know, I bet you didn't know we had images this good of all these Kuiper belt objects.
Why is there a splash bug on Pluto?
Elliot Young told me that there was a, excuse me? Oh, yeah, okay. I could have fixed that next time. Oh, come on, this thing's not working. And this size shows you 2,000 kilometers, so these are pretty big objects. And the work on accretion in the Kuiper Belt by people like Alan Stern and Kenyon and Liu argue that you need something like 10 Earth masses in the Kuiper Belt today in order to explain these big objects. And this is a plot from Stern and Caldwell in 1997 showing essentially the growth time of objects as a function of the disk mass. And you see, to get things below a billion years, you need to be pretty massive. To point out that Alan's timescales are a little longer than Kenyon and Liu's, but it's essentially the same idea. So we have this nice, pretty picture. Okay. Well, let me explain. Excuse me.
Quit while you're ahead.
Okay. There's some problems with this standard model. I have three complaints, and I'll explain to each of them one at a time, or maybe two at a time. The first I want to talk about is the Oort cloud. And as all of you know, the Oort cloud was made of objects that were ejected from the giant planet region, mainly from the Uranus and Neptune region. Therefore, we can really use, if we understand the dynamics of Oort cloud formation, we can really use measurements of the amount of material in the Oort cloud as constraints on the initial protoplanetary disk. And in particular, for this discussion, I'm going to restrict myself to the outer Oort cloud, with semi-major axis greater than 20,000 AU, because that's the region of the Oort cloud we can see. There are several estimates floating around the literature of essentially five Earth masses in the outer Oort cloud, but this number is actually fairly uncertain because the masses of the comets are unknown. We actually have good constraints on the number of comets in the outer Oort cloud. We just don't really know the total mass. So it's somewhere around five Earth masses. And I asked Luke Jones to look in to what he really thought the lower limit was, and he came up with one Earth mass using totally arbitrary things. So if you look at recent models of Oort cloud formation, you find out that the Oort cloud is, formation of the outer Oort cloud is very inefficient. Here's a plot from a paper that Luke's working on, I hope. Oh, I guess I need to be pointing at that thing. Ah, this new mouse, there you go. Showing the fraction of mass or fraction of particles in the outer Oort cloud as a function of time as the Oort cloud is forming. You can see it gets up to a peak of only about 0.4% and then slowly decays over the last 3 billion years to somewhere a little less than 3%. So if you combine this number with these numbers, you can actually get an estimate for the protoplanetary disk, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 Earth masses, which is very contradictory to our upper limit of 20 Earth masses that we got from migration. So we have a problem. I should point out that given the real uncertainties in these numbers, we may be able to make this problem go away, although Luke's lower limit gives us a mass of 30 Earth masses in the disk. So I think, or 40 Earth masses in the disk. So I think this is a problem. The other issue has to do with the Kuiper Belt. Remember I said that you need something like 10 Earth masses or so in the Kuiper Belt between 30 and 50 AU to grow the objects that we see. But observations put the total mass there now as only 0.1 Earth masses. So we have to get rid of all this stuff. Now, I'm not going to talk about all this. There's been a lot of attempts to do this. I can come back and talk about it during the discussion period if you want. But let's just say that I don't think any of them work. It's very difficult to get rid of all this mass. So we were faced with a conundrum. We needed a massive disk to build the Kuiper Belt objects that we see, but then really couldn't find a very good way of getting rid of them. The third problem has to do with essentially the size distribution of the objects that Uranus and Neptune are accreting out of. And to illustrate this, we ran a set of experiments where we just placed, I said an Earth mass here, but we varied the mass from somewhere between Mars and Earth mass objects beyond Neptune at the beginning of migration. So we had Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune at these locations. For this example, put an Earth mass thing at 27 AU in a very low mass disk, and one where Neptune would not migrate very far if the embryo weren't there. This shows you the plot of Neptune's semi-major axis as a function of time, and this is what the embryo does. It goes bloop, all the way out to the end of the disk. So here's Neptune, and there's the embryo. Only one of you are laughing. That's pretty sad. Okay, and the point of this is two things. The embryo moves away early on, the embryo just zooms away from Neptune. It's much more mobile. And indeed, our little toy model shows that you would expect it to be more mobile, and also the boundary between damped and forced migration for low-mass objects is at a lower disk mass. So in this disk, for example, the embryo is actually in forced migration. At long time scales, what happens is that the embryo actually needs to hand things off to Neptune in order to migrate. So the embryo goes out, this ends, hits the end of the disk, it turns out in the simulation, but it needs to stay sort of close to Neptune. So as Neptune's slowly migrating, this thing sort of keeps a constant distance away from Neptune. And so what we conclude from these kind of simulations is that if lunar or Mars-sized objects or Earth-sized objects were in the disk where Neptune was forming, they would have migrated out to the end of the disk into the Kuiper Belt and would still be there today. So either these objects didn't exist and you had a really strange size distribution, which I know some of you would like, or we can solve all our problems if we just truncate the protoplanetary disk at 30 AU. And let me explain each of these at a time how we do that. First of all, the Oort cloud. Remember, what put constraints for migration onto the Oort cloud was that we wanted it to be damped. If we put an edge at the disk up to the disk, we can put a lot more mass there. Let me show you a set of simulations in a truncated disk. This black curve represents the run we did with the same surface density as the boundary between forced and damped migration. And as you can see, as we're shoving up the disk mass, we can make some pretty hefty disks and still have Neptune stop at around 30 AU. It solves the small embryo problem because what happens is the embryo migrates to the end of the disk and Neptune just catches up with it because the embryo can't migrate very far beyond the end of the disk and scatters it away. For the Kuiper belt, we circumvent the mass depletion problem because the massive Kuiper belt was never there. Morby and I just recently published a paper where we argued you can take the entire Kuiper belt, form all the objects that we see interior to 30 AU, and push it all out during the migration of Neptune. Let me show you an example of this. This shows eccentricity as a function of semi-major axis. Here is the disk, which in this case was truncated to 35 AU, although I have no reason why, Morby, you truncated it to 35 AU. And what I'm going to show you is you'll see what happens as the mean motion resonances go sweeping through this disk as Neptune migrates. Line shows Neptune crossing orbits. And this is the 2-to-1 with Neptune, and it can just push everything off the disk and make a population of low eccentricity, low inclination objects beyond the end of the disk. So it's more complicated than that. There are four major components of the Kuiper belt. We need to make all of them, and we use different mechanisms to do this. But again, since I don't have the time, you'll just have to take my word for it that I think we can do the whole thing. Remember, I'm armed. So now, you know, when we first thought of this idea of truncating the disk at 50 AU, we started going through the literature and trying to find ways to do it. And it turns out I found five different mechanisms, all that are independent and usually mutually exclusive of one another, that can explain a sharp edge to the protoplanetary disk. Interestingly enough, some of these only truncate the region of where planetesimals formed and not the nebula. So going out and looking at sort of, for example, the Proplids and Orion won't really put a strong constraint of this. I'll just show you one of these at random. For example, Stu's. I chose this because he's more likely to sit on NASA review panels than anybody else on that list. And what you see here is the surface density of the disk as a function of distance from the sun at different times. This actual model has macroscopic objects that are accreting while undergoing radial migration due to gas drag. And you can see in this particular case, you get a fairly sharp edge. In this case, at 40 AU, he missed by a little bit.
I can tweak my parameters and put the edge where you
want. I'm sure you can. Okay. So, how am I doing on time?
-7.
You mean I've gone on too long for 7? Okay. Okay, so I'm actually going to have time, therefore, to talk about one last aspect, which I was pretty surprised when we saw this, and we're still trying to figure it out. And that's what happens in that's what happens in very massive disks. And what we did is we did one of those simulations I showed you earlier where we had the disk going from 18 to 50 AU and put Neptune in the disk. Here's the disk edge, and this shows the semi-major axis of Neptune as a function of time. And it migrated to the end of the disk, and it stopped. And then it bounced off the end of the disk and started migrating back in. And we were like, huh. So Morby had the bright idea of sometime in here, what we did is we just took the simulation that we had and pulled out all the giant planets but Neptune, and then put in more disk particles and extended the disk all the way out to 200 AU. Okay? following this, and this is what we got. This is migration without any other planets there. It's just tootling along. Look at the timescales, man. This is millions of years. In less than a million years, it moved from 40 AU to 120 AU. This thing is getting a speeding ticket. And we call this runaway migration. It's very similar to type 3 migration, it turns out. And the basic idea is if, well, let me, perhaps the best thing to do is just show you a snapshot of how this works. Okay, so here is some snapshot at some random time. Eccentricity versus semi-major axis. Neptune is at 93 AU at this beginning of the simulation, or at this point in the simulation. This curve and this curve represents objects that are crossing Neptune, right, if their inclinations are zero. So all this stuff out here and here aren't crossing Neptune anymore. This line is the line where the angular momentum in the z direction of the particle is the same as the planet, okay, again, assuming zero inclination. If you had a population of objects where the angular momentum in the z direction is greater than Neptune, Neptune's response is to move out. While if you have a population that's less than Neptune, Neptune's response is going to be to move in. So watch what happens as the simulation goes. As Neptune's moving out, we're feeding more and more objects here in from the disk on the positive side. And that's what supports the outward migration. And in a very short period of time, this thing moved like 10 AU. It's really, really, really hauling ass. Excuse me, Robin. And she was right. I embarrassed Thweery. Okay, so I'm done. I got through this faster than I thought. I was rushing. Here are my conclusions. There are three basic types of migration depending on surface density, type 1, type 2, and type 3. Damp migration could have happened to Neptune, but it's difficult to reconcile this with the Oort cloud formation and the observed TNOs that we see. And the most likely solution to this problem is that the protoplanetary disk was truncated at 30 AU. This talk, if you noticed, was all done in HTML and JavaScript, so it's already on the web, except for some of the changes I made this morning. And I'd like to thank NASA for funding me. Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you. So I better keep this on. You're not allowed to ask questions.
I actually had two questions. One was if you could comment on how your runaway migration relates to the model of migrating planets that Norm Murray et al. Published some years ago. And the second question was, in the hypothetical event that you and Morby had written a paper about Sedna, would you like to say anything about that paper?
That's a good question. The first question, I must admit, we haven't looked at yet. So we really need to look at that paper. I'm sorry. It's the same thing? Okay. And so there's the answer to your question. The second question, let's talk about this first. And if people want us to talk about Sedna, I can talk a little bit about Sedna. I hate the name.
Monday there's going to be a blackboard
How, in your runaway migration simulation, what's your explanation for the depletion on the negative side?
You don't get depletion on the negative side. What's happening is, let me go back to that. As this thing is migrating, particles from this inner edge are being scattered directly to that inner edge. So they're being scattered from objects with perihelia just crossing Neptune, aphelion just at Neptune. You can see the density is much higher here, for example, than it is in here.
So you skipped a couple of slides on the different populations in the Kuiper belt. I'm curious how you can get the cold belt from...
Well, actually, the simulation that I showed you
did have those.
Was the one that created the cold belt. Oops, wrong slide. Okay. If you look at the Kuiper Belt, it's got a really amazing and complex structure. Okay. First of all, you have the resonant objects, which I've really already showed you. There's a population that includes these green things and probably objects that come in through here, which is the scattered disk. And you heard about the scattered disk this week. This population is actually the classical Kuiper Belt. One of the really amazing things about that is look at that edge. That edge is almost precisely at the 1 to 2 mean motion resonance with Neptune. It's quite spectacular, actually.
What is the asteroid?
For it's a different reason. So you need, but also this hot population, if you look here, can be divided into two populations. There's a dynamically cold population in through here, and I don't have good slides for this, and then a dynamically hot population in through here. And you may say, well, now wait a second, that looks like bull. But if you look at this, actually, they have different physical properties. The hot population has larger objects, and they tend to be grayer in color. So you can really prove that you have two superimposed populations in the Kuiper Belt at that point. So we need to make the scattered disk population, the resonance population, and the hot and cold classical belt with these models. And as I already showed you, you can get the resonant population just due to plain old migration from Reynaud's original work. Rodney Gomez did some excellent work about a year ago where he showed that as Neptune is migrating, occasionally you'll get an object that gets scattered by Neptune. Let me show you a little graphic that was in Nature about this. Occasionally, what will happen is you'll get an object that's scattered by Neptune, but it'll, just for coincidence, hit a resonance of some sort, which will bring its peri up from Neptune and actually trap it in the Kuiper Belt. And you can fairly well reproduce the dynamically hot classical belt with that. And you can also reproduce, by ejection, the scattered disk. So when Morby and I turned our attention to this problem, we were after the cold belt. Okay? And since the cold belt ends approximately at the 1 to 2, we figured, well, the way to do it is with the 1 to 2. So what we invoke, which is the animation I just showed you, is objects getting trapped in the 2 to 1 and being pushed outward. Okay? Now, in the standard theory of migration, that would increase the eccentricity of the objects. But what we found is if you put mass, if you make the amount of material in the resonance massive, that generates secular resonances that actually keep the eccentricities cold during the migration. So you can actually keep this population of cold, low eccentricity objects even as the objects are pushed out. And then occasionally they fall out of the resonance and that leaves the cold population. And since the 1 to 2 doesn't excite inclinations, it keeps a really cold, you essentially preserve the initial inclination distribution. It depends on, I mean, what we did is we invoked the grainy migration to get things to leak out. So it depends exactly on the details of how grainy the migration was. But you tend to lose things at the low eccentricity end. So you can still get high eccentricity 2 to 1 librators, which we do see, and a dearth of things at low eccentricity.
So I was going to make sort of, in some ways, a similar point, which is that you need a mass distribution that's sort of top-heavy. If you have a lot of small particles, they're going to collide a lot.
Well, that's true. None of this.
You've got to have collision times that are longer than the libration time in that resonance, which is a pretty reasonably long time. So it's going to take, you know,
yeah, but the migration is really fast.
The libration.
Yeah, I mean, no, migration is really.
You know, I know. Well, even that is it. Well, I guess it's still.
It's a million years or so.
Yeah, and what's the libration period in the resonance?
Do you know?
It's 100,000. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So collision time's got to be longer than 100,000 years. Hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, if you had low enough mass bodies, it wouldn't work at all, right? I mean, the collision time could get very, very short.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah, you can completely stop.
Yeah, that's, yeah, we didn't look at occlusional history.
Following up on that just a little bit, if you had a range of sizes taking part in this, does that mean that you'd have sort of a size selection effect that you'd be more likely to have the larger ones survive and be pushed out there?
I don't understand why. This is a purely dynamical effect unless you include collisions. Yeah, if the small guys are knocked out of resonance, that may be true.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that we see some of these things that are a few hundred kilometers in size, you know, may be kind of the upper end of the...
This is actually an interesting point because the observation HST observations of Bernstein really does claim to find a dearth of small objects, and there is actually a dearth of small impactors, although on a different scale on Europa. That's a problem that people are trying to figure out. So maybe this is exactly it, that the small guys couldn't get pushed out. I have to look into that. That's a good idea.
Okay, we just solved another problem.
Thank you, guys. That's good. Oh, Morby wants to complain.
Are these mass distributions lacking small bodies or whatever, such that really the estimate of the total mass depends on the largest body, or is the largest body so big that it would be treated dynamically differently like that?
Which problem are you talking about?
I'm talking about your estimates of the mass of the Kuiper Belt as well as the mass of the Oort cloud. Is the distribution so top-heavy that the biggest body matters, or is there something truncating it at the top?
Well, you know, we don't know the size distribution very well for those objects, but if it were a top-heavy size distribution, it would make the problem significantly worse, because the mass I was giving you is actually the mass of comet-sized objects, right? So if you had a very shallow size distribution that would allow a lot of things in the big end, that would make the problem much, much worse.
So Hall said that we didn't look into the business of collisions, and this is not true, and I like to contradict him as much as I can. So in fact, what we did, we are working with Sébastien Charnoz in Paris, who studies this collision evolution model. So what we have taken now, it's the same size distribution we observe in the Kuiper Belt. We have scaled it up by a factor of 100 in order to have a sort of primordial mass, and then gone through the simulation and looking on what collides with what and having a dynamically evolving size distribution. What comes out is that sub-kilometers particles really are very effective to be broken, and they are collisionally eroded. But when you go to multi-kilometer particles, they suffer very rarely disruptive collisions.
You did that with our push-out scenario?
We did that with migration, taking the original Gomez simulation, 2003 Gomez simulation. The small guys, certainly, they get destroyed, knocked out of the resonance, but when we come to discuss of bodies, size that we see, they do not suffer any
efficiency
important
in the
collision.
Capturing of the resonance is actually small. Right, so when it comes to this issue of the push-out scenario, you really need to do the calculations for the push-out scenario, not for the migration.
No, but even in forgetting about the push-out scenario, I mean, you have a massive extended disk, and you have Neptune migrating through it, so you have resonance capture. Okay, a la Malhotra. And so the question is, do the trapped bodies go up in eccentricity or are they knocked out before?
Right.
And the answer is that if you look at multi-kilometer objects, they are not knocked out. They have collisions are fairly rare.
Yeah.
But sub-kilometer bodies, yes.
He's right, yeah. He's right, we did do that. It's hard to keep track.
The lady to my left wrote a paper about the size distribution of objects in the Kuiper Belt, and she explains the deficit of small objects in the Kuiper Belt as a result of collisions. And the differences may be that what we assumed is that the objects are held only by gravity and not by strength, meaning gravel piles. Then you can have very small bodies with the 1 km/s velocity dispersion in the Kuiper Belt destroying larger objects. And you can predict where the break in that size distribution should be, and it comes to be more or less, we predict something like 50 kilometers, and the observed one is something like 70 kilometers. And also the slope behind that break seems to be compatible. So we think it's simply collisions ongoing today in the Kuiper Belt.
For the Bernstein hole?
Yeah.
Well, I'll...
It's an
two comments, right? Look, this is not my game, right? But But my boss, right, whose gamut this is, right, says, not, I mean, even Robin's boss, so two bosses up from me, has worked on this problem. Excuse me? Yes, you know? Anyway, and not only that, there was somebody at Swery sent out an email to the office saying that I'd be speaking now, so I'm probably fired. But, you know, they, both Kenyon and Stern, did a similar calculation and got very different answers. So much so that it calls the Bernstein et al. Results in the question, because what they did, and I'm just reporting what I was told, is they took the large objects that Bernstein et al., that everybody claims to see, in the current Kuiper belt with the current mass and the current dynamics and the current orbits, right, and just took the big guys, and they claim you make a collisional tail over the age of the solar system that contradicts the Bernstein et al. Result. Okay, that you would create so many little guys from the collisions of the big guys in the age of the solar system that'd be more there than they observe.
That's right. In Kenyon simulation, that collisional tail has the Doniani spectrum.
Yes.
But the Doniani spectrum is based on the fact that the bodies are held by material strength. And what we did, we generalized that to the case where they're held only by gravity. Then the spectrum becomes steeper, meaning less, well, depends how you measure it, but less bodies of small sizes. And that fits the Bernstein tall paper. So I think there is no problem.
Okay. It is true that both Alan, I don't know what Q-star actually Bernstein uses. I think it's something really weird. But Alan uses sort of a standard Holzapfel and size Q-star distribution, which does have strength in it. So,
Hal, two concerns. One is that these very massive disks imply a very massive gas disks from which they supposedly are derived, the solids, and these actually run, I think, past the notion of a stable gas disk. You need so much matter that they would be actually, you know, you were talking about 200 Earth masses. If you want this mass in that region, then you would have first
the Oort cloud formation argues that it was 100 Earth masses, which is like four times the minimum mass of a nebula, right, Luke? Something like that. Yeah, it's not that big.
Okay. Well, the second thing is that if your time scale, well, I want to congratulate you on getting up to speed with your migration now, because I like fast migrations. But now that you're up to speed, your three types of migration might start colliding with the gas migrations. That is, they all take only millions of years. And that means that your assumption, your basic assumption, which you mentioned in the beginning, is that you don't like the messy stuff. I don't know why you call gas messy stuff, because I call the oldest variety of orbits messy stuff, and I call the unique flow field of gas the nice stuff.
Like vanilla ice cream too.
But no, seriously, what's the justification for neglecting gas while it should still be around at some level, and even if a small amount of gas can modify the eccentricities a lot?
Well, I agree with what you say, that all this neglects gas. And indeed, I think, which is an issue I didn't go into here, I think these migration simulations pretty much show that you need to have gas around when Neptune's forming. Although I can't, you know, getting the timescales right still, I think, is a problem. But I don't, and the basic idea is, again, I said something like this, that the boundary between damp migration and runaway migration, and forced migration, goes down as the mass of the planetesimals, the mass of the protoplanets go down. And so, although with a 20 Earth mass disk, Neptune will be damped, with a 3 Earth mass thing, it's forced. Okay, so I can't see how you don't start building Neptune, and as soon as it gets to an Earth mass or so, it just goes out to the end of the disk without having something holding it in. And the only thing we've been able to think of is the type 1 migration from gas.
Any more questions? These guys can. Okay.
Just to respond to Pavel's first point, the disk that I was using this morning actually was more massive than the one that Hal is invoking, and I did worry a bit about whether that would be stable, and I did a check on that and computed the tumor rate parameter for it, and it was stable out to past 50 AU. Depends on what you assume for the temperature, of course, but I think it was quite reasonable to have a stable disk with that kind of mass.
Thank you.
So I have another comment on Raheem's remarks, which is that currently what you see is a fairly steep, if you believe Bernstein, which I do, fairly steep distribution for small bodies. But that means the primordial distribution, maybe not primordial, but at some point it was even steeper in the past, because you're arguing that it's a collisional tail that you're seeing. But that means that there were fewer smaller bodies sometime in the past. And you're saying that you're draining more out the bottom end than you're supplying at the top end.
Yeah, because the rubble piles are so easy to break off.
Right.
Yeah.
Where do they go?
We're working on this.
Yeah, that's it's a problem.
Yeah, yeah, it's a
problem. Yeah. It's about the mass every year. And that's
Norm. I'll bet your pitcher of beer they're wrong. Yeah. Okay. Maybe the next time we do this, we'll be able to answer that. But I'm pretty certain they're wrong. Look, I mean, historically, I mean, if you look at what they did, you know, they go through this very complicated, I've done this, right? And I got the wrong answer, too. Complicated data reduction of stacking images and adding and doing all this stuff. And at one point, they had like 20,000 candidates that they're whittling down and trying to get to three. It's very, very complicated procedure. And I can easily believe that they missed a few objects. And on top of that, historically, if you look at the Kuiper Belt, whenever people have been pushing the envelope of limiting magnitude, they've always gotten a size distribution that's significantly less than what's observed. You go back, at, you know, 95, when Dave Jewett was claiming the slope of the size distribution is somewhere between 1 and 2, and it's 4.5, okay? It's historically always been that way. And I think it's dangerous, at least, for us to go running off in a direction saying, ooh, we have to explain this observation, when I think it's really on sort of shaky grounds. It was a valiant attempt, man. What they did was beautiful work, but they could easily have missed a couple objects, especially high inclinations, because of the bug that was in their code about, they put in fake data, right, and tried to find the fake data, but it turns out there was a bug in their code and they only put in low inclination objects. So I'm dubious.
Any more questions? Okay, let's go on to the next talk.
Thank you.
You don't want to talk.